Hudson Taylor, In Early Years, The Growth of the Soul, Chapter 35, Ebenezer and Jehovah Jireh. September and October 1857, it was about this time that a pair of scrolls made their appearance in the sitting room at KUEN-KIAO-TEO that were as new as they were perplexing to the little company of Christians and inquirers gathered there on Sunday morning for worship. Beautifully written in Chinese, each character in itself was intelligible. But what could be the meaning of this strange combination? I-P-I-E-N-I-S-E-H-E-R-J-E-H-H-U-A-I-L-A. The young missionary who had been ill and confined to his room for a month could have exclaimed, for it was there in quiet communion with God those inspired words had come to him in such fullness of meaning as to make them forever memorable, Ebenezer and Jehovah Jireh. Hitherto hath the Lord help us, and for all coming need, the Lord will provide. How he rejoiced as strength came back to unfold to his Christian friends their precious message, leading them on to a deeper knowledge of the infinite God they too were learning to trust. That little inner circle, small though it was in number, was the joy and rejoicing of Hudson Taylor's heart. And the illness that laid him aside during the whole of September was made the most of for prayer on their behalf. Taking out of the busy round of preaching and medical work, he was able to give more time to individual inquirers, amongst whom Mr. NYI, a businessman in the city, was perhaps the most encouraging. Passing the open door of the mission house one evening soon after Mr. Jones and his colleague had settled there, he observed that something was going on. A big bell was ringing, and a number of people were passing in, as if for a meeting. Hearing that it was a Jesus Hall, or place where foreign teachers discoursed upon religious matters, he too turned in, for as a devout Buddhist, there was nothing about which he felt more concerned than the pains and penalties due to sin, and the transmigration of the soul on its long journey, he knew not whither. A young foreigner in Chinese dress was preaching from his sacred classics, and this was the passage he read. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so the Son of Man be lifted up, and whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. It is scarcely possible to imagine, much less describe, the effect upon such a man of such a message heard for the first time. To say that NYI was interested scarcely begins to express all that went on in his mind, for he was a seeker after truth, one of the leaders of a reformed sect of Buddhists devoted to religious observances. The story of the brass serpent in the wilderness, illustrating the divine remedy for sin and all its deadly consequences, the facts of the life, death, and resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and the bearing of all this upon his own need, brought home to him the power of the Holy Spirit. Well, it is the miracle of the ages, and thank God we see it still. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. NYI came into the hall that evening, one of the incredibly vast multitude who, through fear of death, are all their lifetime subject to bondage. And as he sat there listening, hope dawned in his heart. Old things forever passed away, and he was conscious of the sunrise that makes all things new. But the meeting was drawing to a close. The foreign teacher had ceased speaking. Looking around upon the audience with the instinct of one accustomed to lead in such matters, NYI rose in his place and said with simple directness, I have long sought the truth, as did my father before me, but without finding it. I have traveled far and near, but have never searched it out. In Confucius, Buddhist, Taoist, I have found no rest, but I do find rest in what we have heard tonight. Henceforward, I am a believer in Jesus. The effect of this declaration was profound, for NYI was well known and respected, but no one present was more moved than the young missionary to whom he specially addressed himself. Many interviews followed, and Hudson Taylor experienced the joy no words can express as he saw the Lord working with him and claiming the soul for his own. Shortly after his conversion, a meeting was held of the society over which Mr. NYI had formerly presided, and though he had resigned from its membership, he obtained permission to be present and to explain the reasons for his change of faith. Mr. Taylor, who had the pleasure of accompanying him, was deeply impressed by the clearness and power with which he set forth the gospel. One of his former co-religionists was led to Christ through his instrumentality, and with NYI himself became of great value to the KUEN-KIAO-TEO Church. NYI, as a dealer in cotton, frequently had time at his disposal, which he now devoted to helping his missionary friends. With Mr. Jones, he went out almost daily, taking no payment for his services, and everywhere winning an entrance for the message he was so keen to bring. He it was who, talking with Mr. Taylor, unexpectedly raised a question, the pain of which was not easily forgotten. "How long have you had the glad tidings in England?" he asked, all unsuspectingly. The young missionary was ashamed to tell him, and vaguely replied that it was several hundred years. "What?" exclaimed NYI in astonishment. "Several hundreds of years? Is it possible that you have known about Jesus so long, and only now have come to tell us?" "My father sought the truth for more than 20 years, he continued sadly, "and died without finding it." "Oh, why did you not come sooner?" Hardly had Hudson Taylor recovered from his illness and resumed his former activities when a call came to very different service, as difficult as it was unexpected. Over on the compound of the Presbyterian Mission, his friend, Mr. Quaterman, was taken seriously ill. A devoted pioneer evangelist, he had remained unmarried in the 10 years of his life in China, finding a congenial home with his sister, Mrs. Wei. His brother-in-law, one of the Presbyterian missionaries, was absent on a journey, and with little children to care for, Mrs. Wei discovered that her brother was suffering from smallpox. It proved, indeed, to be that dreaded disease in its most malignant form. The patient had to be isolated, and to her great distress, Mrs. Wei could not undertake the nursing. No one else seemed in a position to do so, and the sufferer would have been left to the care of native servants had not Hudson Taylor heard of it. But to him the circumstances were a clear call to go to the help of his friends. He was unmarried and knew that could he have consulted the one he loved, she would not have held him back. As it was, he had to leave it to others to tell her, and almost at a moment's notice hastened across the river to take up his sorrowful task. Night and day, he tended the dying man with no thought of self, doing duty as doctor and nurse in one, that others might be spared the risk of infection. "He has been taken home to be with Jesus," he wrote a week later, "and great was my privilege in being permitted to minister to the Lord in his person, and to see the power of sustained grace." But he did not say how cast upon God he had been all through those terrible nights and days, nor how he felt the strain now that it was over. For the moment, indeed, more pressing considerations occupied him, and he was reminded in a practical way of the scrolls at KUEN-KIAO-TEO. With their precious message. For hardly had he performed the last offices for his friend before he found himself in an unforeseen dilemma. In his attendance night and day upon the patient, he had been obliged to change his clothing frequently, and now all the garments used in the sick room had to be discarded for fear of spreading the infection. A Chinese tailor could soon have provided others, but as it happened, the young missionary could not afford a fresh supply. It was not that he had been suffering from shortness of funds. On the contrary, ever since leaving the CES, he had received from other sources more than he personally required. But he was sharing all that came to him with Mr. Jones and his family, and recently had sent £37 to a brother missionary in need. Thus he had nothing laid by to fall back upon, and now the infected garments had to be destroyed. He would have been in serious difficulty but for the resource of prayer. And just then, strange as it may seem, A long-lost box arrived containing, among other belongings, all the clothing he had left in Chateau 15 months previously. For God is a real father and still knows his children's needs before they ask him. A little incident? Yes. But one that added meaning to the motto of the mission that was yet to grow out of the growth of his soul. Hitherto hath the Lord helped us. The Lord will provide. Hudson Taylor, in early years, the growth of his soul. Chapter 36, Joy Cometh in the Morning. October and November 1857. It is hardly to be wondered at that his attendance upon Mr. Quatermain should have proved too much for Hudson Taylor at this time. But for recent vaccination, the illness that followed might have been much more serious, for it was undoubtedly smallpox and the fever ran high. As it was chiefly memorable for the mercy that averted worse developments and for an experience towards the close that brought him untold comfort. It was early on October 20th, before dawn day, indeed, when some noise in the street awoke him with a sudden start. He could not sleep again, and though outwardly quiet, was stressed by palpitation due to his exhausted condition. And then, when the fatal case of disordered nerves, one misgiving led to another, until he was overwhelmed with painful apprehensions. All the surprise and anguish of the long months of his love for the one who might never be his seemed to come back like a flood gathering itself up in a great fear of what was yet to come. They had suffered so much, their love for one another was so intense, and the opposition it awakened so persistent that it seemed more than he could bear. In a few weeks now, the letter would come that must decide their future. Unreasoning anxiety laid hold upon him, and though he tried to quiet his distress of mind by handing it over to the Lord, the very effort added to his sufferings. But beneath all the while were the everlasting arms. One whose comprehension is infinite was watching over his suffering child, and in the way of all others most sure to help, relief was given. All at once, he wrote to his sister later in the day, I became conscious of my dear Maria's presence. She came in silence as a breath of air, and I felt such a tranquility steal over me. I knew she must be there. I felt spellbound for a short time, but at length, without opening my eyes, I put out my hand, and she took it in such a warm, soft grasp that I could not refrain from a look of gratitude. She motioned me not to speak and put her other hand on my forehead, and I felt the headache which had been distracting and the fever retire under its touch and sink as through the pillow. She whispered to me not to be uneasy, that she was mine and I was hers, and that I must keep quiet and try to sleep. And so I did, awakening some hours later, well of the fever, though very weak. A sweet dream, I would call it, only I was as wide awake as I am now, and saw and felt her touch as plainly as I do now, pencil and paper. All my fear in the fever had been that our love would come to nothing, so you may guess how it soothed me. It was with pleasure Hudson Taylor found that in recovering from his illness that his friend Mr. Bourdon of Shanghai was again in Ningpo, this time to arrange for his wedding. He had been engaged to the elder Miss Dyer for almost a year, and now on November 16th they were to be married. Without in the least grudging them their happiness, he could not but feel the contrast with his own circumstances very keenly, especially in view of Miss Saunderson's growing dislike. For as time went on, she seems, if anything, to have increased her opposition to the younger sister's engagement. Not content with having written fully to Mr. Tarnan in London, she continued to bring accusations of a serious nature against Hudson Taylor. It came to such a pass at length that Maria herself almost wondered that her confidence did not waver in the one of whom she knew so little. But their love was too deep, too God-given. She suffered nonetheless, however, especially during those weeks of illness, his own and Mr. Quatermain's, when she could neither come to him nor do anything to show her sympathy. Yet she had come, although she knew it not. It was rarely the young people could meet even in public at this time, for the school in which Mrs. Dreyer were teaching had been moved across the river to the compound of the Presbyterian Mission. Living with Mrs. Busom in the brown gable-roofed house adjoining the school building, they were near neighbors of the Ways, whose love and adoration
admiration for Hudson Taylor must have been a comfort to the younger sister. He would be frequently spoken of with gratitude as one who had risked his life in ministering to their brother. Footnote: in August 1905, nearly 50 years later, a sister of Mrs. Way's wrote as follows. Letters from Mrs. R. Way of Ningpo would have given delightful reminiscence of Mr. Hudson Taylor, but these letters so much prized, were unavoidably lost. Mr. Way was absent from the city when the sickness of Mr. Quarterman's proving to be smallpox rendered the situation of Mrs. Way and her children very alarming. The doctor had him isolated, and I suppose he would have been left to the care of the Chinese had not our Heavenly Father interposed and moved the heart of his faithful servant, Mr. Hudson Taylor, to take upon himself to be the nurse, brother, and comforter in one. Actuated by the very Spirit of Christ, he cut himself off from everyone and devoted himself to the care of my suffering brother. The sad details, his sore sickness and death, brought sorrow to our hearts, but how this was tempered by the knowledge that loving hands and devoted care had done all that could be done for our brother, for this dear servant of the Lord, Mr. Hudson Taylor, added another member of the family, Miss G.S. Way of Savannah, Georgia. We have always felt the deepest gratitude, and we ever rejoiced in the great things he was enabled to accomplish in winning China for Christ. End of footnote. And Maria's fingers may have lingered on the keys of the harmony that had belonged to Mr. Quarterman's and was now to be given to her friend. Not that Hudson Taylor felt free to accept the gift. Much as he would have valued it, he dared not lay himself open to further misrepresentation. I could not have taken it, he wrote to his mother, about its having been considered by some as a sort of payment, and that, of course, I guard against, for I would not have anyone imagine that I desire payments in this life for the service of the Lord's people. For the same reason that he might avoid causes of offense, he refrained from visiting Mr. and Mrs. Way on the Presbyterian compound, and waited as patiently as he might without communication of any kind with the one who was in all his thoughts until the letter should arrive, on which so much depended. Meanwhile, with returning strength, he was more than ever busy in the city. The work both in the home he shared with Mr. and Mrs. Jones and in their preaching station was full of encouragement, and they had added to it free breakfast for the very poor that were a special source of satisfaction to Hudson Taylor. The Lord was supplying his needs more bountifully than ever before, and in the spirit of the words, freely ye have received, freely give. He rejoiced to pour out all that he was and had in the service of others. Feeding 60 to 80 people every day was a considerable task on their resources, however, and once and again, they had actually come to the last penny before fresh supplies were received. This very naturally was misunderstood in some quarters, as may be seen from Dr. Martin's interesting recollections. Footnote. I conclude, writes Dr. W.A.P. Martin, recalling early Ningpo days, with two names more eminent than any of the preceding, the names of Robert Hart and Hudson Taylor. From a budding interpreter, the former has blossomed into a famous statesman known as the Great I.G., Inspector General of the Chinese Customs Service. His career, to which there is no parallel in East or West, will be further noticed in connection with Peking. The latter, who rules as many men and with a sway not less absolute, is the Royale of Protestant missions. When I first met him, he was a mystic absorbed in religious dreams, waiting to have his work revealed, not idle, but aimless. When he had money, he spent it on charity to needy Chinese, and then was reduced to sore straits himself. When the vocation found him, it made him a new man. With iron will and untiring energy, he erred in leading his followers to make war on ancestral worship, instead of seeking to reform it. Still, in founding the Chinese Inland Mission, he has made an epoch in the history of missionary enterprise. From a cycle of C-A-T-H-A-Y, end of the footnote. But both Hudson Taylor and his colleague were walking prayerfully before God in the matter, and he honored their faith while allowing it also to be tested. Many think I am very poor, wrote the young missionary in the middle of November. This certainly is true enough in one sense, but thank God it is. As poor, yet making many rich, as having nothing, yet possessing all things. I would not, if I could, be otherwise than as I am, entirely dependent myself upon the Lord, and used as a channel of help to others. An incident was before him at the moment of the care and faithfulness of God that he could not but share with his home circle. For only a few days before they had found themselves in sore straits at KUEN-KIAO-TEO, through their work of love and mercy, 1,700 people, the poorest of the poor, had had their breakfast that morning, had listened for an hour or more to the story of redeeming love. NYI, who had just been baptized, and others of the native Christians, were very helpful on those occasions, and no doubt found their own faith strengthened by the experiences they witnessed. Well, on that Saturday morning, continued Hudson Taylor, we paid all expenses and provided for the morrow, after which we had not a single dollar left. How the Lord would care for us on Monday, we knew not. But over our mantelpiece hung two scrolls in Chinese characters, Ebenezer and Jehovah Jireh. And he kept us from doubting for a moment. And then, the very day, letters that had traveled half across the world reached Ningpo with no mail was expected. Posted in England 2 months previously, they had been brought in safety over land and sea, and so prospered on their journey that the prayer, "Give us this day our daily bread," was answered before the sun went down. That very day, concluded Hudson Taylor, the mail came in a week before it was due, and Mr. Jones received a bill for $214. So once again, we thanked God and took courage. The bill was taken to a merchant, and though there is usually a delay of several days before we can get the money, this time, he said, "Send down on Monday, and I will have it ready." We sent, and though he had not been able to buy all the dollars, he let us have 70 on account. So all was well. Oh, it is sweet to live thus in direct dependency upon the Lord, who never fails us. On Monday, the poor had their breakfast as usual, for we had not told them not to come, being assured that it was the Lord's work, and that he would provide. He could not help our eyes filling with tears of thankfulness, as we saw not only our own needs supplied, but the widow and orphan, the blind, the lame, the destitute, together provided for by the bounty of him who feeds the sparrows. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusts in him. O fear the Lord, ye his saints, for there is no want to them that fear him. The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they that seek the Lord shall not want any good thing. And if not good, why want it? Very soon after this, Hudson Taylor found that the Lord had been working for him in other ways also. For it was, towards the end of November, the long-looked-for letters came and were favorable. After careful inquiry in London, Mr. Tarn had satisfied himself that Hudson Taylor was a young missionary of unusual promise. The secretaries of the Chinese Evangelization Society had nothing but good to say of him, and from other sources also he had the highest references. Taking, therefore, any disquieting rumors he may have heard for no more than they were worth, he cordially consented to his niece's engagement, requesting only that the marriage should be delayed until she came of age, and that would be in little more than 2 months' time. Oh, China, China, how the said young missionary longed after that to see what someone else would say, and how distractingly difficult it was to arrange an interview. To cross the river forthwith and present himself at Mrs. Buesom's would have outraged all proprieties. Anywhere on the compound where she lived, indeed, they could not have met under the circumstances, and his own home was still more out of the question. But news of this sort flies fast, and in some way, Mrs. Knowlton of the American Baptist Mission heard of the situation. She was in favor of the engagement and lived in a quiet place outside the city wall and close to the river. She would send a note to the school. Miss Dreyer could come to see her at any time, and if somebody else were there, well, such things will happen, even in China. So it was in Mrs. Knowlton's drawing room he waited while the messenger went slowly, slowly across the river, and it seemed as if he would never return. Let us hope that the windows overlooked the ferry, and that Hudson Taylor had not to keep up the form of conversation. At last, the slender figure, quick step, bright young voice in the passage, and the door opened, and for the first time they were alone together. More than 40 years later, the joy of that moment had not left him. We sat side by side in the sofa, he said, her hand clasped in mine. It never cooled. My love for her, It has not cooled now.
Hudson Taylor, In Early Years, The Growth of the Soul, Chapter 37, Perfect in One, December 1857 to January 1858. After this, they were openly engaged and could meet from time to time in the company of friends. And how those happy winter days made up for all that had gone before. I never felt in better health or spirits in my life, wrote Hudson Taylor. To God who alone does wondrous things, who raises up those that are bowed down, and has caused every effort to injure me to work only for good, to him be praise and glory. The engagement was not to be a long one, for on January 16th, Miss Dreyer would be 21 years of age and free to follow the dictates of her heart. So the closing weeks of the year were full of joyous anticipation. It is good to know that in a life so serious as regards its outward surroundings, there were still times when they could be young and gay. One refreshing glimpse into this side of things is afforded by an intimate friend of those days now the widow of the devoted and beloved Dr. Nebius, N-E-B-I-U-S. To those who only knew Mr. Taylor in later life, wrote Mrs. Nebius, it may be a surprise to learn that when he fell in love, it was a headlong plunge, and by no means a slight or effervescent passion. And his fiancée, with her strong emotional nature, was in this respect not unlike him. My husband was rather a special friend of both, and he sometimes indulged his propensities for good-natured teasing at their expense. I was in America, sent home on account of ill health, when the following little passage at arms, or rather hands, took place. One evening, the young people were seated round a table playing a game that required their hands to be hidden beneath it. To his surprise, Mr. Nevis received an unexpected squeeze, guessing at once that it was a cause of mistaken identity, and enjoying the situation, he returned the pressure with interest. In a moment, Maria, his next neighbor, discovered her mistake, but when she would have withdrawn her hand, it was held fast by its captor's strong fingers. Not until flushed cheeks and almost tearful eyes warned him that the joke had gone far enough did he release her. Those were days when to laugh was easy, and not such very funny things were sufficient to evoke much merriment. Perhaps still another person, whose name is known round the world, was sitting at the table, for now Sir Robert Hart was a frequent visitor in our home, and it is quite possible that the now venerable and even then learned Dr. W. A. P. Martin was also a guest that evening. How little we imagined in those days the remarkable careers in store for some of those bright, merry young people. But cares and responsibilities were to come upon them soon enough, and what could have been better in the midst of more serious preparation than just such times as these? They were hard students even then, every one of them, and probably erred on the side of overwork. A very different experience, one that might well have given the young girl pause, had her character been other than it was, occurred on the eve of their marriage a few weeks later. It was the 6th of January, said Mr. Taylor, recalling the circumstances in conversation with the writers, and the bride-elect was coming to tea at KUEN-KIAO-TEO in company of Mrs. Abusin. They had been arranged some time previously when we were under no anxiety as to supplies. But when the time drew near, we found ourselves in serious difficulty. Expenses had been heavy on account of our work among the poor, and mail after mail had come in bringing nothing from home. At last, in the morning of the day in question, one solitary cash, the 20th part of a penny, was all that we had left between us. But though tried, we looked to the Lord once again to manifest his gracious care. Enough remained in the house to supply a modest breakfast, after which, having neither food for the rest of the day nor money to obtain it, we could only betake ourselves to him who is a real father and cannot forget his children's needs. And you may be sure that what was to me the most painful element in that situation, our unpreparedness for the guests who were coming that evening, was specially remembered before him. After prayer and deliberation, Mr. Jones agreed with me
that we ought to try to dispose of some sellable article in order to supply our immediate needs. But on looking around, we saw nothing that could well be spared, except perhaps a clock, and little that the Chinese would purchase for ready money. Credit, to any extent, we might have had, but that would not have been in accordance with our principle in the matter of debt. So the clock was taken to a neighboring merchant, who proved a willing purchaser. But, of course, you must leave it for a week, he said, that we may see how it goes. No one would think of paying money down for an untried clock. This was so reasonable from the Chinese point of view that there was no gainsaying to it, and we saw that there was no help for us in that quarter. One other article remained, an American stove that could have been sold for old iron, but we much regretted parting with it. Still, it seemed necessary, so we set off for the foundry, which was at some distance. On the way, however, our path was unexpectedly closed. The bridge of boats by which we had intended crossing the river had been carried away in the night, and all that remained was a ferry, the fare for which was 2 cash each. As we only possessed 1 cash between us, our course was clearly to return and wait God's own interposition on our behalf. Upon reaching home again, we found that Mrs. Jones and the children had gone to dine with the firm. The invitation, accepted some days previously, had induced Mr. Jones, but included him, but under the circumstances, he would not hear of leaving me. So we set to work and carefully searched the cupboards. Though there was nothing to eat, we found a small packet of cocoa, which, with a little hot water, somewhat relieved us. Our Chinese cook then came and begged his master to make use of the small sum left of his wages. But to this, Mr. Jones could not agree, as he explained to the man, adding that although we could not go into debt, even for necessary food, our Heavenly Father knew all about it and would soon supply his children's needs. But though he spoke with confidence, our faith was not a little tried, as we went into his study and gave ourselves to waiting upon God. We cried indeed unto the Lord in our trouble, and he heard and delivered us out of all of our distresses. For while we were still on our knees, the cook came to the door. Oh, teacher, teacher, exclaimed, here are letters. Once again, a mail had arrived from home several days before it was expected, bringing, as we found to our thankfulness, a generous gift from Mr. Berger. Whoso is wise and will observe these things, even they shall understand the loving kindness of the Lord, who, that ever trusted in him, was put to shame. Over a happy tea table that evening, the whole story came out, for their hearts were so filled with joy and praise that they could not keep it to themselves. The wedding had been arranged for January 20, just 2 weeks later. But in the light of what had taken place, Hudson Taylor felt that he must put before his loved one the most serious aspects of the step she was taking. Very fully, he told her, when they were left alone, just what the trial had been. I cannot hold you to your promise, he continued, if you would rather draw back. You see how difficult our life may be at times. Have you forgotten the sweet voice that you posed? I was left an orphan in a far-off land. God has been my father all these years, and do you think I shall be afraid to trust him now? My heart did sing for joy, he said, as he told the story, and it might, for the price of such a woman is far above rubies. So the preparations for the wedding went on, outwardly with the kind help of many friends, and inwardly with the blessing of God. Some of the lessons he was learning at this time may be gathered from the last letters of Hudson Taylor, penned before the happy event. I can scarcely realize, dear mother, what has happened. After all the agony and suspense we have suffered, we are not only at liberty to meet and be much with each other, but that within a few days, TV, we are to be married. God has been good to us. He has indeed answered our prayer and taken our part against the mighty. Oh, may we walk more closely with him and serve him more faithfully. I wish you knew, my precious one. She is such a treasure. She is all that I desire. Yet the first place in his heart was truly given to him, whose love exceeded all human affections, as he wrote in another letter, and who can fill the soul with gladness to which all other joy is unworthy to be compared. Now I know what it is to have my name written on his heart, and why he never ceases to intercede for me. His love is so great that he cannot. It is overwhelming, is it not, such depth of love, and for me? The wedding day was perfect, setting a crown on all that had gone before. Footnote.
January 20th, 1858. End of the footnote. In brilliant sunshine, Hudson Taylor crossed the river and made his way to the old temple near the Presbyterian compound. That did duty as a consulate. The Reverend F.F. Gouge, G-O-U-G-H, was there already at his office as chaplain, with friends from all the different missions, officers from the British gunboat, and a few other foreigners. Mr. Robert Hart represented the absent consul, and Mr. Wade, the father of the bride. Very sweet and fair, she looked in more than Hudson Taylor's eyes that day, in her simple gray silk gown and wedding veil. He was wearing ordinary Chinese dress, and to some the contrast between them must have seemed remarkable. But to those who could see below the surface, the noteworthy thing about that wedding was the way in which the bride and bridegroom were already perfect in one. The reception afterwards in the hospitable home of Mr. and Mrs. Way, the speeches and all the kinds of congratulations passed like a dream. But it began to seem more real when early sunset found them alone together along the western hills. And the days that followed were far better than any dream. From the guest room of the NIOH Wang Monastery, Hudson Taylor wrote a week later, January 28th, we are so happy. The Lord himself has turned our sorrow into joy, giving us the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness. January 29th, he has answered all our prayers, overruled the opposition of those who would have us separate us, justified the confidence. He enabled us to praise him and made us very, very happy indeed. And from Ningpo, when 6 weeks had gone by, oh, to be married to the one you do love and love most tenderly and devotedly. This is bliss beyond the power of words to express or imagination conceive. There is no disappointment there. And every day, as it shows more of the mind of your beloved, when you have such a treasure's mind, makes you only more proud, more happy, more humbly thankful to the giver of all good for this best of earthly gifts. Hudson Taylor, in early years, The Growth of the Soul, Chapter 38, Our Joy and Crown of Rejoicing, 1858 to 1859. A new home, especially if it is to the Cedar Bride, is just as interesting in China as elsewhere, and Hudson Taylor found himself quite popular on Bridge Street. When in the early spring he remodeled the barn-like attic in which he had formerly dwelt alone. Not only was he married, a change that in itself entitled him to consideration, but he had married the well-known D-A-Y-I-A, then capital K-U-N-I-A-N-G, who for 5 years had lived and worked in that part of the city. In addition to being a bride, she was the trusted friend of many a woman and girl throughout the neighborhood, so that visitors were numerous when the young couple came into residence, as they did towards the end of April. This was 3 months after their marriage, and in the interval they had broken ground in a country district 8 or 10 miles from the city. From the quiet of NIOH-1 Monastery, they had moved to a busy little town, MOH-TZ-IM, on the shores of the Eastern Lake. Surrounded by a large fishing population, they had spent a happy month living and preaching Christ among those who had never heard. Love and joy, it seemed, were a wonderful talisman with which to open hearts, and it was a real sorrow when illness obliged them to abandon the native cottage in which they had been living and return to more suitable quarters in the city. Long weeks of nursing followed, for the fever was nothing less than typhoid, which attacked them one after the other. It was evident that it would not do to return to MOHTZIM for the summer, and so while continuing to visit it as an outstation, Mr. Taylor decided, as we have seen, to occupy the premises on Bridge Street, where it would not be necessary to sleep on the ground floor. So it was there, over the channel, between the narrow street in front and the channel behind, in the little rooms that were to form the cradle of the China Inland Mission, and are now its oldest home, that the young missionaries began settled work. Downstairs, everything remained as before, but a few small chambers were fashioned above with inexpensive partitions. Chinese furniture was easy to be had, and housekeeping was a simple matter to one so familiar with the language and ways of the people. Then it was that Hudson Taylor, like his father before him, discovered that
Whosoever findeth a wife findeth a good thing, and obtaineth favor of the Lord. Missionary life was no longer a one-sided pastor affair, but rounded out and complete in all its relations. He began to feel in touch with the people in a new way, and was able to understand and serve them better at every point. And the gentle presence that made the sunshine of his home was loved and welcomed by the neighborhood, by the neighbors all about them. Quite freely she went in and out of their courtyards, seeking pupils for her little school, chatting with the children, delighting the women with her understanding of their everyday affairs, and cheering the old people with ready sympathy. There was something about her bright face and pleasant ways that made them want to know the secret out of the peace she possessed, and many came to the meetings in the mission house to hear more from her lips of the Savior who made her life so different from their own. Thus, a light began to shine from the new home on Bridge Street, and brightened many a heart in that great heathen city. And both husband and wife realized how much marriage may help the missionary in his work when it is not only in the Lord, but of him, through him, and to him. They were not without their anxieties, however, in common with all others in Ningpo this summer, for it was a time of painful excitement both in and around the city. The Tai-Ping Rebellion, still at the height of its power, was moved rapidly towards the rich providence of CHEH-KIANG, upon the conquest of which its leaders had determined, and the inhabitants of Hangzhou, SHAO-Hing, Ningpo, and other important places saw themselves powerless to avert a calamity that defied imagination. Little or no assistance could be expected from Peking. Worst in the unequal conflict with England, the broken-hearted emperor had witnessed the collapse of all his hopes as to protecting his country from foreign opium, and the capital was about to surrender before the might of European arms. With such affairs on hand, what help could be given to a distant providence over which were harboring the harpies of civil war? And as to self-defense, the experience of 8 terrible years had taught the people only too well that success lay with the rebels, and there was no safety but in flight. And for flight, the pain-stricken inhabitants of Ningpo were already preparing. Great alarm has been felt in the city, wrote Mr. Taylor early in June, on account of the approach of the rebels. Many wealthy men have moved their families, and in fact into the country, some pawnbrokers have been forfeiting their places of business. You will be aware that the latter are a wealthy class in China, something like bankers at home, and are therefore the most likely to be attacked in the event of serious disturbances. Passing along the street, making purchases in shops, and even when one is preaching, people stop one to ask if the rebels are coming. And though the excitement is less than it was, this still continues. Footnote. It was a needless alarm for the time being, for not until 3.5 years later, December 1861, did the rebels succeed in possessing themselves of Ningpo. But the tragedy when it came justified only too fully all the terrible apprehensions, reducing the population of the city and its immediate surroundings to barely a 20th part of its former number. End of footnote. Even the capture of its forts at Tien-Tsin, guarding the approach to the capital, aroused the villagers. It was too far off to make much difference. But here, close at hand, were the dreaded long-haired rebels, and heaven itself seemed indifferent to the calamities of the people. For, to add to their distress, the spring and autumn crops were largely ruined through an unusual rainfall. All over this part of China, day after day, week after week, the clouds poured out for torrents. Rich and poor were alike filled with consternation, and large sums of money were lavished at the shrines of many an idol. The Mandarins, great and small, had been to the principal temples to pray for fair weather, Mr. Taylor continued, but of course in vain. When will this poor people cease to lean on them and turn to the only living and true God? Never, I suppose, until he comes whose right it is to reign, and to whom shall the gathering of the nations be? All this, of course, seriously affected missionary work at Bridge Street, as well as in other parts of the city. Sometimes the preaching hall was almost empty, and hardly a passerby was to be seen in the streets. This was when the rain was especially heavy. Again, at other times, Mr. Taylor had all he could do to keep the crowds in order, and the preaching was constantly interrupted by questions as to the troubles that engrossed the thoughts of the people. There were not wanting difficulties also in the work itself that called for faith and patience, chief of which was the lack of native helpers.
Mrs. Taylor, happily, had succeeded in obtaining one or two servants, although they were wont to disappear on the least provocation, or even without any. But Christian fellow workers, they had none. Preaching, teaching, prescribing, and dispensing medicines, as well as entertaining visitors by the hour, Mr. Taylor had to manage single-handed. In addition to business affairs, correspondence, and evangelistic excursions with Mr. Jones. It would have been possible, of course, to employ a heathen teacher in the school to which Mrs. Taylor gave 6 or 7 hours daily, and they might also have taken on some of the inquiries with a view to training them for positions of usefulness. But either of these courses would have been a hindrance, they considered, rather than a help. To pay young converts, however sincere, for making known the gospel must inevitably weaken their influence, if not their Christian character. Later on, the time might come when their call of God to such service would be evident to all. But in their spiritual infancy, at any rate, they should be left to grow naturally in the circumstances in which God had placed them. Strengthened by the very trials with which they found themselves surrounded. Meanwhile, special faith and devotions were needed to enable the missionaries to do so much themselves, and in their insufficiency, God worked, bringing them in contact with hearts ready to receive the gospel, giving them as their children to the faith men and women who should become soul winners, and in the fullest sense their joy and crown of rejoicing. One of the first of these after their marriage was the basket maker, F-A-N-G, then N-E-N-G-K-U-E-I, introduced at Bridge Street by his friend, Mr. N-Y-I. There was a something about the Christians that greatly attracted him. Long had he been seeking peace of heart, but neither in the ceremonies of Buddhism nor the philosophies of Confucius had he found any help. He had even attended for a time the services of the Roman Catholics, but not until he joined the little circle at Bridge Street did he begin to understand the rest of faith. Then nothing would satisfy him but to be there every night as soon as his work permitted, following eagerly all that was said and done. It was about this time that Mr. Taylor, finding his audiences diminishing, bethought him of a plan to arouse fresh interest. He had at hand a set of colored pictures illustrating the gospel stories, and put up a notice to the effect that these would be on view at the evening services, when they would also be fully explained. The result was all he had hoped for. The Chinese dearly loved pictures and stories. One night the subject was the prodigal son, and the young missionary preached with more than ordinary freedom. With the crowded room before him and eager faces peering in from the street, one can well imagine how he would speak of the experience of the wanderer and all the father's love. The thought of God as such a father was strangely new to most of his hearers, and when at the close Mr. Taylor invited any who wished to hear more to stay behind for conversation, almost the whole audience remained. Among the most interested were N-E-N-G-K-U-E-I and 2 friends whom he had brought to the meeting. Others richer by degrees, but these 3 stayed on and seemed much in earnest when they said they wished to become followers of Jesus. Mr. Taylor had recently started a night school in which inquirers might learn to read the New Testament by means of Roman letters. This exactly suited N-E-N-G-K-U-I-E-I and his friends, and for some time they were regular in their attendance. Then it began to be rumored abroad that the basket makers were becoming Christians. They had a good deal of persecution to put up with. This, of course, tested the reality of their faith, and to the sorrow of the missionaries, first one and then another ceased to come. Would N-E-N-G-K-U-E-I too drift away? But in his case, the work proved deep and real. Persecution only brought him out more boldly as a good soldier of Jesus Christ, and ridicule taught him to defend his newfound faith in such a way that he became a most effective preacher of the gospel. But N-E-N-G-K-U-E-I's earnestness in making known the truth as it is in Jesus was due to something deeper than external opposition. He was a man called of God to a special service in place of the divine providence in a special school. In spite of more than one fall like Peter's, whom he closely resembled in character. N-E-N-G-K-U-E was to be widely used in winning souls to Christ. Wherever he went, in later years, he was enabled to raise up little churches that continued to thrive and grow under the care of others. N-E-N-G-K-U-E was not one who could long minister to them himself,
But he realized this and was also ready to pass on to new fields when the special work was done. And the zeal and devotion that characterized him must be attributed under God to the influences by which his Christian life was formed and nurtured. Few, though there were in number, Hudson Taylor gave himself to the young converts at this time, as if the evangelization of China depended upon their future efforts. In addition to all his other work, he devoted several hours daily to their instruction. Mr. Jones was a recognized pastor of the church, and Sunday services were held in his house. Footnote. The KUEN-KIAO-TEO house had been given up soon after Mr. Taylor's marriage, and Mr. and Mrs. Jones were now living in a purely Chinese residence, about a mile from Bridge Street. End of the footnote. But the older Christians, several of whom were already baptized, were just as eager to attend the Bridge Street classes as were the most recent inquirers. First came the public meetings every evening, when the hall would be filled with more or less regular attendance. And when that was over, the outsiders had, for the most part, withdrawn. Three periods were given to regular and carefully considered study. To begin with, a lesson was taken from the Old Testament, the young missionary delighting to dwell upon the spiritual meaning of its national stories. When a chapter was read for some important book, frequently the Pilgrim's Progress, and finally a passage from the New Testament, was talked over, the virgin years being the Romanized collegial. Nor was this all. Sunday, with its special meetings, morning, afternoon, and evening, was made the very most of for the inner circle. It cost the Christians a great deal to leave their regular employment, sacrificing the practical possibilities of one day in seven. It was perhaps the hardest thing their Christian faith required of them. Yet the command was plain, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And Mr. Taylor and his fellow missionaries were convinced that no strong, self-propagating church could be built on any other basis. So they constantly enjoined upon the native Christians by teaching and example the requirements of Scripture in this connection. And as due compensation, if it may be so expressed, they felt it incumbent upon them to make the sacrifice worthwhile, as far as in their power lay, by filling the hours thus given to God with profitable occupation. In addition, therefore, to the regular meetings, they had two periods of teaching, after the fashion of the American Sunday School, wherein old and young Christians, inquirers, patients, school children, and servants were divided into classes and taught in a helpful personal way. This made Sunday a heavy day for the missionaries, of whom there were only four, but if it cost some toil and weariness, they were the better able to appreciate the sacrifices made by the converts. Some had to walk long distances and go without food for the greater part of the day, and others had to face persecution and financial loss. NENG-KUEI, for example, found that it cost him a full third of his weekly wages to attend the meetings on Sunday. He was a skilled workman, and his master was quite willing that he should get through all there was to be done in 6 days, provided he went without pay on the seventh. If it gave him satisfaction to waste 4 days in every month, he was at liberty to do so. Only he must, of course, provide his food on those occasions and draw wages only for the time in which his work was done. It was a clever arrangement as far as the master was concerned, but one that told heavily on the poor basket maker. 2 pence a day and his food had been little enough before, but now, out of only 12 pence a week instead of 14, he had to spend 2 or 3 in provisions for Sunday, which meant a total lessening of his hard-earned income by a third. But he was willing, quite willing for this, if only he could have the Lord's Day for worship. And there could be no doubt that he was richly repaid in the strength and blessing that brought him all through the week. Another element of great importance in the training of these young converts was the emphasis placed on reading for themselves the Word of God. This it was that brought out the exceeding value for the uneducated among them of the Romanized version of the Ningpo New Testament. For the local dialect differed greatly from the written language, and hence the more literary versions were unintelligible to the majority. But there was no one who could not understand the Romanized version. It was a very fair translation, direct from the original language into the vernacular in everyday use, and as such, had a special charm for the women, who could soon read it easily and found that what they read was understood by others. Footnote. Mr. Taylor spent the larger part of his first furlough in association with the Reverend F.F. Gough, G-O-U-G-H.
In carefully revising the Romanized New Testament and supplying it with marginal references, a work which Archdeacon Moule of Ningpo stated many years later to have been of the greatest value to Christians throughout the province. End of footnote. Mrs. Taylor was fully one with her husband as regards the importance of teaching every inquirer to read, including women and children, and gave a great deal of time to preparing and even printing on her own printing press suitable literature in the Romanized collegial. She found that by the use of this system, a child of ordinary intelligence could read the New Testament in a month. Older people with less time at their disposal might take longer, but even for busy women, it was no difficult task, and the experience proved that those who accomplished it rarely, if ever, failed to become Christians. Mrs. T.S.I.U., the teacher's mother, was a case in point. When her son was first employed at KUVN-KIAO-TEL, she was angered and distressed by his interest in the gospel. Reading the scriptures daily with Mrs. Jones and other foreigners, he had a good opportunity for studying the practical effects, as well as the teachings of Christianity, and before the missionaries had any idea that a deep work was going on in his heart, the young Confucius had become a humble follower of Jesus. "May I purchase a New Testament?" he inquired one day. "I want the easy kind, printed in Roman letters." "But you can read WEN-LI, replied his pupil. "Would you not rather have it in the scholarly character?" "It is not for myself," said the young man earnestly, "but for my mother. And will you not pray that she may learn to read it and obtain heavenly influences, may have her heart changed and her sins forgiven?" Full of thankfulness over the conversion of the son, the missionaries joined him in earnest prayer for his mother, sharing also his conviction that if only she would learn to read the Gospels, she too would love and believe in Jesus, and so it proved. For though Mrs. T.S.I.U. refused for a long time to have anything to do with the religion of the foreigners, her desire to be able to read at last won the day. She was flattered by her son's assurance that she would soon master the new system and be as fluent a reader as those who had long studied character, and that, moreover, everybody would understand the meaning of what she read. With this help, she made rapid progress, and meanwhile, the message of the book was doing its work in her heart. Taking her stand boldly as a Christian, Mrs. T.S.I.U. was a great cheer to the little company of believers all through those summer months, for she was full of joy and courage. She opened her house for a weekly prayer meeting, which became a center of blessing in the neighborhood, and was never so happy as when reading and explaining to her neighbors the precious book and its story. Footnote. Those were red-letter days indeed when N-E-N-G-K-U-E-I, the basket maker and the teacher's mother, were baptized and received into the little church. This took place on August 15th and 29th, Sundays, when the chapel of the American Baptist Mission was available. Mrs. T.S.I.U. was the first Chinese woman Mr. Taylor had ever baptized, and his address on the reproach of Christ as greater riches than the treasures of Egypt came from a full heart. End of footnote. This was, of course, a great encouragement to the missionaries and quickened their zeal for the instruction of all over whom they had any influence. The burden on their hearts increasingly was that of raising up, as workers together with God, a band of native evangelists for the as yet unreached interior of China. To go themselves seemed for the time being out of the question, and yet the country was accessible as never before. The Treaty of TIEN-TSIN, signed during the summer, had opened the way at last to all the inland provinces. Footnote. This treaty, signed on June 26, 1858, was the utmost importance in our relations with China. It obtained excellent provisions, such as the right of maintaining an ambassador at Peking, freedom for foreigners to travel in the interior of China, and toleration for Christianity, so that persons teaching it or professing it should alike be entitled to the protection of the Chinese authorities. But alas, under the tariff supplement, it also contained a clause legalizing the importation of opium, against which the Chinese had striven so long. End of the footnote. Foreigners had now the right to travel freely, under the protection of passports, and it only remained to make use of the facilities for which they had prayed so long. Lord Elgin's report of his official journey with a view to testing the new order of things was deeply interesting. No hindrance had been put in his way as he steamed
slowly up the Yangjing, 600 miles to the newly opened port of Hangzhou, the commercial metropolis of central China. Nothing was to prevent foreigners from settling there now, ministers of the gospel as well as government officials and merchants, and many were the missionaries who longed to enter that open door. "You will have heard before this all about the new treaty," wrote Mr. Taylor in November. "We may be losing some of our Ningpo missionaries who will go inland, and will not the church at home awaken and send us out many more to publish the glad tidings? Many of us long to go. Oh, how we long to go. But there are duties and ties that bind us that none but the Lord can unloosen. May he give gifts to many of the native Christians, qualifying them for the care of churches already formed, and thus set us free for pioneering work." Nothing else, nothing less, would have kept Hudson Taylor and his young wife from proceeding at once to the interior. But the claims of that little band of believers could not be set aside. They were their own children in the faith, and though not a large family as yet, were just at the stage when they most needed watchful care. It was to their love, their prayers, these souls had been committed, and to leave them now, even for the good of others, would have been to disregard that highest of all trusts, parental responsibility. And they were right in this conviction, as the blessing of God abundantly proved. For these Christians, NYI and NENG-KUEI, and the rest, were men whom the Lord could use. Poor and unlearned, like most of the first disciples, they too were to become fishers of men. No less than 6 or 7, indeed, of the converts gathered about Mr. and Mrs. Taylor this winter were to come to their help in later years as fellow workers in the China Inland Mission. Footnote. The laborers of Mrs. T.S.I.U. and her devoted son. Of N.Y.I., the cotton merchant. N.E.N.G-K.U.E.I., the basket maker. Wang, the farmer, and Wang, the painter. See next chapter. Not to speak of L.O.H. and then A.H.-T.S.I.H. and others can never be forgotten. It would be difficult to overestimate the services of that little band in connection with the earliest stations of the mission, services extending over 10, 20, 40, and even 50 years, and ending in unclouded testimony to the glory of God. End of the footnote. But for them, the nurture of that little seed amid so many difficulties would have been almost impossible, and much of its promise might never have come to fruition. Already in the winter of 1858 to 1859, there were signs that rejoiced the missionaries in the midst of much to try both faith and love. But even so, they little realized the importance of the influence they were exercising, directly and indirectly. What they were themselves and the deepest things, this to a large extent their children in the faith became. And there is no better, surer way of passing on spiritual blessings. Imitators of us and of the Lord, those things which you have both learned and received, and seen and heard me do, and that God of peace still be with you. Thus it was the Lord trained his own disciples in the 3 wonderful years, and thus it must be still today.